I'd like to talk to you now a little bit about this thing called self-determinism. We've talked about some automaticities. We've talked about some other matters. Probably got your own machinery going half seas over by this time. It's a very dangerous thing to talk about somebody's automaticities. Very amusing thing to do with an actor. We take this actor and we say to him, you probably don't recognize this as being a stunt, a gag, something that by which we pull somebody's leg. Actor comes in and he's going through certain actions, and you say, just how do you act? How do you do that? Well, I took my training at the Abbey Players and so forth and so on, and I use the Stanislavski school, and I do this and that, and this hand posture means, it's expressive and so on. It's a fantastic thing. He hasn't got any better sense than to explain to you about how he acts. See? And then he comes on next time, you know, and boy, he's just completely cross-eyed. He is supposed to accept the tea tray from the butler, you know, and he drops it and so on, and he's a mess. You've taken him half off of automatic. So you've made him just sufficiently aware of his automaticities, these machines which tell him how to work. By the way, the word machine is not used loosely. A person really does set these things up as machines. And you've taken it half off of automatic. But he has not talked back to the machine. He has talked to you, which makes him more of an effect of the machine and reduces his self-determinism over his ability to act. And the funny part of it is he doesn't need any machine to know how to act. That is the most fabulous thing you ever heard of. He doesn't need a machine to do it. All he has to do is know how to do it, and he'll do it. But he has already made the mistake. He put up acting on a machine, which then told him how to act. And now he is acting, and he's holding his hands this way, and feet postures this way, and it means this, and it means that, when he does something or other, or grimaces, and so on. He's rather annoyed occasionally to have some young actor with no schooling at all come on stage and do a much better job of acting. Fella didn't have any training. Never read a book on the subject. Yet he can act. Oh, why is this? Well, the young fellow didn't know it was difficult. But he will after he's been around this actor for a while. Then he'll have to study to get back to knowing how to act. Writers have a very good time with this. Fantastic time with it. They start in great enthusiasm, very little technical accuracy. But if they can write at all, there's a freshness and spontaneity to their work which brings them a considerable public. It is the life in the work itself. It isn't the exact accuracy of how the words must follow the words, must follow the words, must follow the paragraphs. It is not that. It's the fact that what they're writing about is alive. They were interested in it. They expect people to be interested in it, and people are interested in it. And then, as time goes on, they meet enough writers, usually, who tell them they'd better study. And they do. And after they study very hard, very long, very arduously, they become technical perfectionists. They become masters of the comma and are no longer masters of the public. Interesting, isn't it? They become perfect in their parsing and broke in their bank account. The average life of a professional writer is only about 3 years. 3 years of popularity. That would seem to be a statement open to some question. So is any statement open to question made by anybody, including me. But you see a few writers around who have been going for a decade or two. But these are the exceptions. The young fellow who does not fill in the lead stories of the magazines, who does not appear regularly in the bookstores, but who puts the volume of books there. The young fellows who put most of the books and most of the stories out are not these long-term, die-hard writers. They are people who start writing and learn how to write and stop writing. They lose their public. Too often we see the first novel as being something tremendously fresh, something that is very interesting. And then we want another book by the same chap, and maybe we see the second novel, and it still has something of interest in it. And then we see the third novel, and we don't see the fourth at all. It never even got published. We're all acquainted with this phenomena in the field of writing. And exactly what happens to him is that he sets up his writing as an adjunct to the machine of his language. And he is writing more or less from some quarter of his head at last. He set it all up on automatic. He did not know that he was the one that turned it on or the one that turned it off. He's lost this ability. In other words, self-determinism is missing and machine determinism is present. He's being run by studies, experiences, and not by his own choice. Now, the funny part of machinery, the funny part of automatic responses, the funny part of an individual's circuits, you might say, is that they're not alive. They're not as alive as he is, but they can look more alive than he is if his self-determinism over them has almost dwindled to nothing. The individual himself might be barely alive, but he's totally a collection of educated responses. Very often, you meet a policeman who is totally a machine policeman, you know. It's not up to him. He fills in the reports and he asks the questions and he does this and he does that. And he himself is really no longer there. He's sort of a slave to the machine. Curious that you can upset him terribly. It's curious. By just failing to fulfill the exact role that is expected in you by the machines. You just aren't the right role. There's a fascinating thing of investigating an investigator. Someone is coming to investigate you. You start investigating him at once. And you throw his machine out of gear. He's liable to get very upset, but if you're pleasant, he can't find any reason to get angry with you, you see. But he's under investigation. The traffic policeman who pulls you over to the side of the road is taken quite aback if you pull out of your glove compartment a pad of paper and a pencil, more or less the size of his ticket book. Step out of your car, put your foot on the hubcap of his car or some such thing, and start asking him for his police history. You are not at any time unwilling to produce your licenses and everything, but all in due time. You want to know first whether or not this is a legitimate undertaking into which he's engaged. And if you do it smoothly enough, and if you do it with a sufficient aplomb, if you're courteous enough to him, so on, the chances are very much in favor that he will simply get back in his car and drive away. Not doing it gently enough, he's liable to put you in and drive away. But nevertheless, that may still be better than having a ticket. Now, as we are made the effect of the various automaticities in the society, as we're made the effect of these various set-up responses like the police, as we're made in effect by various bureaus and various organizations inside the government, we continue to be in effect so long as we ourselves do not speak back. But above that level is something else called self-determinism. Power of choice. Self-determinism could be called power of choice. Do you know that an individual very often falls back to a point where he himself is no longer determining even himself? He's just going on and on. He's walking through life. The machines tell him to do this, and the government tells him to do that, and other people around him tell him to do something or other, and he just goes on and on and on. He isn't happy. There's nothing there to be happy. He himself has almost dropped out of existence. He's no longer visible or detectable. We look for some life in this person. We don't find any. Well, how could we put some life into him? We could rehabilitate his power of choice. A man who is drafted into the army will rarely make a good soldier. This is so true that we wonder why the army is trying to commit personal suicide on its own behalf. Why would it ever draft anyone? It was a custom started by Napoleon. Is directly antipathetic to Anglo-Saxon beliefs, activities. Oh, it probably existed long before Napoleon was called Levy. Napoleon started it on a mass national scale. He had it really oiled up. Conscription is simply the confession on the part of an armed force that it is no longer capable of producing enough interest in it to cause it to be served. It's merely saying we're no longer interesting enough to anybody, we have to use force. We can no longer attract a young man or pay him enough wages, so therefore we can't excuse all this, so we must therefore draft him. That's what it confesses. I would think a long time before I would make such a confession, but they have gotten quite shameless about it. Even in peacetime, they do drafting. But the funny part of it is that a drafted soldier is rarely a very good soldier. He remains a civilian, the last thing he was before his power of choice was overcome. And usually an individual will do this. He will remain the last thing he was before something overcame his power of choice. He will hold on to the last exercised power of choice in most cases. The young man who was drafted remains a civilian. He was to some degree choosing to be a civilian. But more importantly, let us say that he was working to become a grocer. And then they drafted him. And he goes right on through the army being a grocer. And you know, grocers aren't worth a nickel at the end of a machine gun. They really don't fire well. They're more likely to pitch cabbages or something like that. It's an interesting thing, but he's retaining his last power of choice. Throughout the one of the recent wars, one gets sort of loses track of them, you know. But throughout one of the recent wars, we had this astonishing thing occur time and time again, that the individual officer would come up to us and say, well, now, before all this happened, before I came into the service, I was an insurance executive, you know. He was Wavy Navy or something of the sort. And I was an insurance executive, and I was very good as an insurance executive, and insurance executing is this, and insurance executing is that, you know. I quit a 90,000-pound job per year. He even makes it good, see. Makes it real good, unbelievably so, in order to take over this commission as a sub-lieutenant, and that's what I'm doing here. Now, we've all met that chap. Actually, his arrival in the armed forces might have been three steps ahead of the conscription service, but his power of choice, to some degree, or to a large degree, was overcome. And so he remains the last thing he was where he had a power of choice. Only in this wise does he believe that he can go on existing and breathing and being to some degree himself. He must exercise to some degree a power of choice. It becomes very interesting, this thing, when we look it over, since a power of choice is actually the lowest order of decision. We've already been presented with two or more situations to have to exercise a power of choice amongst them. But it still is a first cousin to decision. It still has decision connected with it. An individual says, I did not want ham, I did want steak. The steak is tough, but I will eat it. Supposing he'd walked in and simply been served steak. Even if it was good steak, he'd say it was tough. See, he had no power of choice over what he was being served. Somebody simply gave him steak. Well, a man will complain about almost anything he is given in this wise. He has no power of choice. A smart commissary officer, in order to keep peace between the cooks and the troops, would always have two items on the menu. There would always be two tureens from which the troops could be served. And although one contained boiled dog and the other boiled mule, he could still ask, now would you have boiled dog or boiled mule? And the troops, by and large, would feel more satisfied with the commissary department. They would think they weren't doing too bad a job, mostly because they had been permitted to exercise to this tiny degree a power of choice. But where we come through and serve them only boiled army issue, even though it's good, growl, 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 growl about the chow. What are they really growling about? What are they really upset about? What's all this commotion about? It's just that nobody has given them the power of choice. And so it is in all of life, one could say, that where you find, with people in general, where you find a great deal of upset and unrest, tumult and confusion, we have simply omitted this thing called the power of choice. And it can exist, it is so powerful a factor, that it can exist in the shabbiest, lowest excuses of choice, and people will still put up with it and still function like boiled dog and boiled mule. They will choose between two people running for an office, neither one of whom should be permitted to shine harness in a livery stable. But they're permitted to exercise power of choice. The people let them go to the ballots and they say, well, now it will be Jinx or Jones. They can choose one or the other. Therefore, to some degree, they will put up with the government. You see, Jinx and Jones, it's no choice at all. How they ever got nominated in the first place was a tremendous mystery, best explained by somebody else's cash box. But let us say that Jinx suddenly walked up and said, I am now the representative of this entire district, and you're going to do what I say. No, that's a dangerous thing for a man to do. Remember, the public would have been no better off with Jones in there. But nobody exerted a power of choice between Jinx and Jones, so therefore, Jinx steps up, says he's it, no choice is exercised. The next thing you know, they're giving him some real estate, 6 feet worth. You see this? Well, now that's about as far south as you can go on power of choice, politics, ballots, so on. Unless the public itself is able to express its choice originally. If you really wanted people satisfied with the government, and the government is doing just terribly, I mean, everything is crashing on all sides, and everybody's satisfied with the government, then you would find present this thing, that everybody had been permitted to choose on his own free discretion who the candidates were that eventually stepped up to the ballot box. And not only that, but choose the committees that chose the candidates. And if everybody chose everything on their own determinism decision, and they eventually got around to arresting Jinx, who at this moment is no better than he ever was, you see, everybody'd say, well, we elected him. There he is. But we'd also feel we could talk to him. And we get the lower order at work, too. Communication becomes possible. He's there because we said he'd be there. And we believe that. All right. If we could talk to him, then there's a good chance that the group at large would accept not only his decisions, but would accept very, very logical, well-worked-out decisions, too. Not just getting mad because Jones advanced that one, you know. The group would stay in communication with itself. People would keep talking to each other. Issues like this or that could be settled then easily because people still communicated with people. When we drop down power of choice to nothing, people stop talking to people. That's very interestingly true. Machines start talking to machines. We drop the power of choice out, it's gone. Communication goes too. One of the reasons why is, as Jinx steps up, says, I'm now the Grand High Generalissimo of the area, and anybody that disagrees with me is going to be herein before stated as per Proclamation 86, nailed on the wall there, going to be shot with one bullet. The public says, let's see how we can get around exercising a little power choice around here. Let's have some revolutionary parties. Let's have some undergrounds. Let's have some counter-revolution. Let's do something. Because obviously we can't communicate with this fellow because we never at any one moment had any choice in his being there. So what would they do? They would start enough commotion so that Jinx would have to appoint enough captains of the guard to keep the peace, and these failing, because they could not keep any check at all in the revolutionary underground activities, would have to get a secret police, and the next thing you know, anybody talking to anybody else would be suspect as an informer. And so nobody dared talk to anybody, and it'd all go out the bottom. I wouldn't give you 5 rubles for such a nation, not mentioning any particular nations. I wouldn't. It would not be safe to live in it or expect anything of it. No power of choice is being exercised. Well, now as we look over all of these factors, involved in choice, we recognize at once that life is sufficiently complex so that it would be impossible for us to make all the choices that are being made ourselves. This would be impossible. Well, it's mainly impossible because there's somebody else alive. A point which some people overlook. And if we make the choice for everybody that is alive everywhere, do you know there's nobody for us to talk to either? You see, we've gone out of communication. Pity poor Franco. Pity the poor chap. There he sits, nobody to talk to. So the other day he dreamed up the fact that he was going to turn it all into a monarchy. Probably just because he could talk to somebody of equal rank. It's a fabulous thing. He's gone out of communication because he sought to make choice for everybody, everywhere. And nobody can do that. Nobody can do that. Because everybody has his own concerns, and if everybody isn't left with some power of choice, we have a great deal of difficulty stirring up. We don't have any live people left to choose for. That's the inevitable result. Here's a fantastically complicated thing just to start out to make the power of choice for everybody that's alive. We choose what they're going to eat for breakfast and what they're going to eat for supper and who they're going to marry and how many Kropotniks they've got to put into the collection plate or whatever it is or the party plate. And not much difference. We choose this and choose that, and we establish this and we establish that, and we establish something else. We're making powers of choice for everybody. And then we wonder why the level of the culture keeps going down, 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 down. Of course, it'll go down. There's no self-determinism being exercised by anybody anywhere in it. It's a fantastically important thing. One is sometimes torn between trying to get a show on the road and get some efficiency going somewhere and another, and the fact that he must not depress out of existence the life that is present. That's an interesting power of choice, let me assure you. Now, where we have a power of choice being exercised, we have, to some degree, life present. If we wish to increase the amount of life, we increase the power of choice admissible. We increase the individual determinism. Now, it increases from just the first dynamic, the individual himself. We call that the first dynamic. It increases from just the first dynamic on up through the dynamics. Determinism. To determine the course of or the decision about. And an individual, to be in very, very good condition, would have to have a fairly free power of choice or decision or determinism, all more or less the same thing, on all of the dynamics. And if he had power of decision and choice on all of the dynamics, why, we would have an interestingly sane society. Interestingly sane. It would be confused here or there, but you'd walk into the society and you would certainly get talked to. You would certainly be talked to by people and talked with. People, everybody'd be in communication with everybody. They felt they had a right to be. If you walked into a society without a power of choice, where power of choice on the various dynamics had been tremendously neglected, why, you would discover nobody communicating with you at all. These are the two symptoms. Now, what do we mean by on all the dynamics? The dynamics are eight in number, and it's just the urge to survive on the part of the individual, the first dynamic, through children, sex and children, second dynamic, groups such as clubs, parties, nations on the third dynamic, mankind, the fourth dynamic, the animal kingdom and all other life, the fifth dynamic, and then on the sixth dynamic, the physical universe, seventh dynamic, the idea of the spirit, beingness, and the eighth dynamic is, of course, the dynamic of infinity. It's really the dynamic of universes, but most people call it the dynamic of God. All right. Now, here are the areas of choice possible. There are probably more possible than that, but they're more or less summed up into these eight parts, and you see that each one is an increasing sphere of choice. Now, you think, theoretically, that complete self-determinism would be just the thing to have. Complete self-determinism. Oh, that would be great. If the first dynamic, the individual himself, could choose everything for himself that was to be chosen, we say, that's a terrific condition. And that's almost as bad as none. Because the individual has no game. He has nobody with whom to communicate. He has nothing to find out, nothing to study. He has no motion or action in which he can engage. He is never at any time an effect. And he is as bad off as an individual who is effect all the time. In other words, he's always outflowing. Somebody else is always inflowing. Both are equally difficult to achieve. Self-determinism is quite difficult for some people to grasp or understand. For only one reason, and that is that self-determinism, if exercised without any regard for any other dynamic, without any regard, that is to say, for any other person or group, but all for oneself, results in no game at all. And some people who are quite silly believe that when we say self-determinism, we mean that the individual himself, for himself, should have a total power of decision and choice with relation to everything else. And we get a silly condition like this. I saw a chap who believed that one time. There's a ball. A ball was lying on the floor. And he said to a girl that was there, he said, "Now I'll show you what self-determinism is. What really self-determinism is." Now, he said, "That ball It's lying there on the floor. All right. Now, if I want that ball, I will get it. Now, he said, that's self-determinism. And little girl, she said, but what if I want the ball? Well, if you reached for it, you'd get killed in the rush. That didn't sound like self-determinism to me. That sounded like psychosis. The actual full exercise of self-determinism or pan-determinism would consist, interestingly enough, of this. Willingness to let somebody else choose, too. And it required some communication in there. Now, a fellow would say, I want the ball. And a little girl would say, well, I want the ball. And you'd say, well, okay, well, who needs the ball most? Or what are we going to do with the ball? Maybe we can both have the ball. And the little girl says, well, all right. And they start rolling the ball back and forth, and you have a game. Otherwise, one has this interesting picture of somebody sitting there clutching a ball in his hands. All for one means none for all. As a consequence, there's no game left. An interesting thing that individuals, as they walk around, do not realize that their own happiness and cheerfulness does not really depend on getting their own way so much as it depends on making sure that they can get their own way and that other people can get their own way too. That's the oddity. A person who is really in good shape is willing to let somebody else make up his mind too. And you have a game when this gets going. It isn't all then just for me, you know, that kind of a thing. It is never all for me unless it's all for thee too. And when you get all for me and all for thee going at the same time, you get war. Unless you want perpetual war, then all for me doesn't work. For instance, we had a nation, interesting country. I don't know what it's doing now. I picked up a couple of bricks recently and looked underneath it trying to find that country, but I didn't see very much. A country called Alemania. It went to war with several nations recently because it said, all for me. And nobody agreed with this country. All for me. We are their master race. Therefore, we own everything. Jawohl. They said everybody else has got to be a slave to the master race. Setting up one master race. They don't realize, sometimes people don't read enough textbooks or have enough good sense. If they haven't got enough good sense themselves, they read textbooks, by the way. And by the way, that goes for practically all of man. They individually know what's instinctively right, and then they get everything messed up on what is instinctively right, and somebody comes along and has to tell them what was right all over again so they can get rid of some of the stuff that they swallowed and couldn't quite digest, which is the only role Scientology really serves. Anyway, we have amongst the Eskimo a very interesting thing. You know, the white man in general is very, very proud of himself genetically. He thinks he is the kind of the master race. And it's very interesting in cruising around amongst the Aborigines and various barbaric units of the fourth dynamic mankind to run across occasionally a philosophy which is not quite right, not quite the same philosophy as the white man has about himself. One time I was in a group of Eskimos, and they had an Eskimo there, and he just wouldn't work at all. He wouldn't pick up any part of the catch or carry it or do anything, and they started to curse him. And they said, yab, yab, and so forth. Eskimo is such a complicated language, nobody can speak it but an Eskimo. But they were going on at him at a mad rate, and they were cursing him up and down, and one word kept occurring. And they kept talking to this Eskimo who would not work at any time, just this one phrase. And I became so curious at last that I asked one of them, their sub chief, what does that word mean? And he said, that means white man. So here we have a difference of viewpoint, one race to another race. And the German nation never could have won anyhow. It would have been impossible for it to have won over any period of time, merely because it was saying, all for me. All for me and slavery for thee, bud. Didn't work. They couldn't even operate long enough to carry on a war, much less rule the world. So that anybody who practices this philosophy of all for me and none for thee is not really self-determined at all. He's trying to wipe himself out because he isn't going to have any game. He isn't going to have anybody to talk with, and he isn't going to have any pay of any kind since there's no comparable terminal, nobody of the same size as he is, to pay him anything. And just from this token alone, it'd be impossible for self-determinism to exist totally on the first dynamic. Now, we get the opposite of that, which is no self-determinism to exist on the first dynamic and all self-determinism to exist on the part of the group. We get a slave state. Nobody in the state can live for himself. Nobody has any right to choose what kind of a stove he gets to sleep on all winter. He simply is told by the group that that is the kind of stove he will sleep on. You get the idea? And he sleeps on it. That's that. But he's led to believe that the third dynamic must live and the first dynamic must suffer in accordance. And he must never work in this fashion. So we get opposed to all for me. We get opposed to that none for me. And you could actually convince people that they ought to live this way on the basis of none for me, all for the group. See, we could convince people that so they would never then themselves exercise determinism. And this too perishes. This too goes by the boards. Why? Because we are enhancing one of these dynamics at the expense of another one. So you could have the first dynamic way up and the third dynamic way down. In other words, the individual urge for survival as an individual way up and urge for survival as a group way down. It's a non-survival situation. Won't work. Or we could have first dynamic or individual survival way down and group survival way up. Won't work. In the first place, you just can't get them that far apart and still have a game or communication or anything else happening. So the individual himself has to make up his mind how much he himself is going to choose and for what, as opposed to how much the other individual is going to choose and for what. And the process of settling this is called communication. And we communicate all the time, one way or the other, airing our views one way or the other, thrashing things out, and that is pay. It could be said that the only pay there is communication. Now, when an individual is totally for himself and nobody else, or when he is totally for everybody else and not for himself, he alike perishes. In both ways, he has no great forward thrust. His machines, his automaticities, his decisions get unbalanced, and he himself really isn't there to like or dislike anything. He disappears. What happens to him? Well, he just sort of withdraws. There isn't any interest in the situation, really. An individual may conceive because everybody is so mean and everybody's so nasty and everybody's so ornery, and he is the only fellow around with good intentions, that he therefore shouldn't talk to anybody else. He shouldn't allow anybody else any power or consideration. The decisions other people make are too dangerous. Decisions other people make are too upsetting. They're too lacking in wisdom. So therefore, nobody must make a decision but himself. This is a sad state. It's a very sad state. He eventually winds up by making no decisions for himself or anybody else. He just starts running totally into the ground. Similarly, where no individual is ever consulted, And this thing called group, without any individuals really running it, is supposed to go on running automatically and working it all out for us in some fashion. That perishes too. There's nobody there to run it. In both cases, we would perish. Now, man at large, is in a conflict between fear that wrong decisions will wind him up in bad, and a feeling that he himself daren't make any decisions because nobody would listen to him. That's an interesting state of mind, but does to some degree describe man today. What's man going to do? What's man going to do today? We find him filling up his own institutions. We find him doing a fine job internationally. In fact, he couldn't do a better job internationally than he's doing. It's so good that there's no international now at all. He got together an organization called the United Nations, and then nobody took any responsibility for it, and the wheels kept on going. Everybody expects the United Nations to do something about the atom bomb, the United Nations third dynamic, without any individual rights in it whatsoever. And so it's never going to function. It hasn't functioned. You read the most terrific things on United Nations stationery, but you see no terrific things occurring as a result of United Nations actions. That's because there's nobody there. It's a wonderful group. Wonderful group with no individual power of choice. Yet the nations of earth are very prone to play this game of all for me and none for thee. They're very prone to play this. They get into an interestingly complicated situation when they do. Other people say, well, the dickens with you then. We're going to put another boundary in here. We're going to raise another tariff wall. We're going to put another customs agent in between thee and me, and that will be the end of that. And the end of that is, of course, confusion, conflict. They are not cooperating one with another in this game called life. They are opposed to each other, and each one bound and determined the other one isn't going to make the decisions. When we get a situation like that, of course, we have, again, no game, and things perish. Now, if you cannot make the decisions for somebody else, and you think you ought to, he's not making any decisions. Do you know that talking to him pleasantly will at length bring him around to making a decision? But you ordinarily are too anxious for the decision to be made. You want it to be made right today. Right this instant, right during this conversation. And you're talking to this fellow, and he's buried underneath of all of his machinery and the pressure of existence, and everything is crushing on him. And you're saying, now make this decision right now. Well, this is such a novel idea to him to make a decision that he probably won't find out what you're talking about for 3 or 4 days. And there he is. And you're saying, now, so therefore you believe that's no good talking to him. Well, it's no good talking to him if he's got to make a decision on the situation right this instant, because he can't make a decision that fast. It's too new and novel. You should just prepare to tolerate a little better the length of time it takes for his machinery to get out of the way and for him to get into action. The darndest thing will happen if you look this over. Well, let's say you're a little kid and you ask this fellow, now give me a sixpence to go to the show, you know. And he says, no, I'll save me money. You're impatient. You conceive that you now cannot go to the show, so you leave. Why don't you come back in half an hour? He'll hand you a sixpence. Did you ever have that happen? Huh? He'll begin to feel guilty. Or something will happen there. Something will penetrate through him that he has been asked something. Now, of course, what your response first came from was machinery, see? The automatic response was simply, somebody is talking to me. Something, if you were a little kid, something that makes an awful lot of noise and confusion and commotion is talking to me. So therefore, the best thing I should do is to push it off and brush it away. And then the message comes through after a long time after, and eventually gets to the guy himself. It goes through various bypasses and wires and through various telegraph offices and relays and back and forth. Maybe a half an hour later, or maybe next morning, which wouldn't do you a bit of good. He'd say, you know, I should have given him a sixpence. It's too late, you see, by that time. But people are always doing this. People will come like half a lifetime. I should have been nicer to Mother. She's dead now. See, isn't that a silly thing to do? But that's just how long it took to reach the guy. It really wasn't a shame, blame, regret mechanism. The message just got through. What you want to do is to do this more expertly. What you do is let's cut a new communication channel by being very nice to the person, because the only thing that ever cuts a communication channel is affinity. Anything else but liking the fellow simply causes him to turn things off. You like him because you like him, not because you say you like him. All right. Now you're trying to cut through a channel, see? You'll eventually get to the guy, and if you work at it right, if you've laid this channel very carefully, you've spoken to him now and then, you've spoken to him pleasantly, then you come up to him and you say, give me a sixpence to go to the movies. And he'll say, sure. What's happened? You aren't traveling through all the vias where you're concerned. That's what makes this communication lag. The individual himself has not been talked to very often, you see? You talk to him a little more and you have a communication channel. Not because you want something, but simply because you want to be in communication with him. Now, let's say you had a boss, and you've asked this boss for a rise. You went in and you said, boss, can I have a rise? And he said, no, get the hell out of here. Standard response, you see. In the first place, you tried to open a communication line which you really rarely use. And then you tried to open it on a subject that had to do with self-interest. See? All at once you did this. Of course your communication didn't go through. He didn't tell you no. That's the funny thing. He didn't say no. His machine response said no. You weren't talking to a guy. You were talking to a piece of machinery. You would have to have demonstrated this to him, that there was a parity of third dynamic and first dynamic going on here. You see, that if you had talked to him more about the job, if you had talked to him more often, if you had originated communications more often, not just jumped up every time he said, come here or something, if you'd originated more communications to him and so on, you would eventually have gotten a communication line established with him in spite of all of his machinery. And the funny part of it is, if you did it well one of these days, well, he would probably say, how about a 2-pound raise? He's liable to do that, see? It'll occur to him. You weren't asking him for the raise all the time. There's two different ways of approaching the same problem, one which has no success and one which has a fair degree of success. But where you think you have a communication line, it's a horrible thing to tell you, you very often don't have one. See, you think a communication line exists, and there isn't one there. That's quite interesting, quite interesting. Let me give you a good example of that. You've supposed that the people of the nation are in close communication with the director of the budget. That's an interesting thing for you to assume. Are they? Well, the best answer to that is, are you? Well, you're the people of the nation. So, if you're not, they're not. So something's running automatic. See? No communication line there. Well, how do you put a communication line there? Well, you start one. See? Simple. Of course, a line after it's been closed for a long time, I'll give you warning. Or when a line doesn't exist into an area that often gets angry, you put one through, it often blows up. goes boom, explodes back down the line. You say, where was the left half of my head? you must be aware of that, so therefore communicate lightly the first time. Don't put a lot of significance on the line. You know, I'm not advocating anybody do this because really the budget will work it all out. If they don't, I'll go down and talk to them. That would be very funny. Bloody Yank, what are you doing in here? I'd say, I slept through an awful lot of courses in economics at Princeton. I'm entitled to have a say. As good a passport as any. At least an interesting one. All right. You put through a gentle line without much significance on it, and you'll find out that you can put through another line. You can put through another line and another line. Now, one of the greatest security guarded agencies in the world today, the other day, communicated with me pleasantly, openly, all good roads and good weather. This organization has the reputation of never communicating with anybody. Its security is so good, it's so terrific and so arduous, that it can't even publish its orders for more security. That's a good organization. I mean, their security is real good. The only thing that ever arrives on anybody's desk there is the paycheck. But do you know, it often has its sum omitted because that is a security item. Now, this organization, I first communicated with it, and it blew up in my face. I called up and wanted to talk to somebody about something. I called over a telephone. Too fast a communication line. Its number was in the phone book. So I looked it up and called its number. And somebody you ask, I asked to talk to somebody on the subject of what was the classification of certain materials or information. I wanted to know this. And they put me through to somebody, and he said, rah, 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 blank. So I said, you know, I suspect that organization has never been communicated with by anybody in the public. I'll just bet you. So I wrote a nice letter, and I asked them if they had an information bulletin of any kind concerning the organization of their organization with reference to its budgets. See, this would be awfully mild sort of information to ask for, because every bureau has something called its budget records, see. And they wrote back and wanted to know why I wanted it. So I didn't bother to explain or take up that subject again. I merely said I wanted an appointment with somebody to find out whether or not I could talk to him. And they answered it and told me that this might be possible. So I wrote and asked them, and I said, who? And they wrote me and told me who. And do you know that the communication lag, the amount of time necessary for an answer of the first letter, was 7 weeks. The next letter was answered in 1 month. The next letter was answered in 1 week. And the next several letters were answered in just exactly how long it took for a letter to get there and get back. Get the idea? I don't know, but what it didn't pick up the whole organization, you know? Maybe everybody started handling things this way. How would I know? I hadn't looked at the other communication lines. But here's an extreme oddity of an organization, a government organization, going into communication with an individual private citizen, and actually did, and arranged for appointments, and we discussed things through the mails back and forth. I never went near the place, by the way. It was of no interest to me whatsoever beyond this one fact. I wondered how long it would take to get them into communication. And I finally got them into communication in 3 months. But you're often too fast. You want your wife to tell you whether or not she wants to go to the show. Or your husband to to tell you whether or not you should go out for dinner. And you make the mistake of asking before it happens, without having much of a communication line there to ask along. And so you get a big lag, you know? You're asking to use power of decision on this matter. You're liable to get a big lag and a stall, and then they put it all off on you, and if the show was no good, if the dinner was no good, they bawl you out. You know, you've had that happen. That's just because they had no power of choice. So you just lay a communication line as gently and as quietly as you can, and you lay the line and let it sit there, and you use it when it's necessary to use, but you keep it open. And you have lines, and you just put lines through to various parts of the world or the government or people and so forth, and you get your communications networks up. Otherwise, you're going to be the effect of all of existence, and you're going to be all for none, you know, one, gone. First dynamic will be all but gone. Why? You're just not in communication with yourself or others around you. About the best therapy I know would just be, for the dickens of it, open a gentle communication line in some direction that you thought was pretty well closed. This would be quite an interesting thing to do. You'll learn a lot. You have to open a communication line with pretty good reality. In other words, you have to talk about something with which there'll be some agreement. And you have to use fairly good affinity. You have to show that you're not mad about it, and that's why you're opening the line. And you have to communicate and be willing to be communicated to, but you can open up communication lines to the darndest places you ever heard of. And you can talk to anybody, providing you don't expect an answer in the next couple of seconds. You could even talk to a government. They'll talk. They don't just send you a form back. The funny part of it is you start writing to a government, why, the more and more alive it is. It's a very funny thing, but practically the only people that police get along with are criminals, just because they communicate with them so much. Criminal goes in, they say, oh, you got a gun? Well, just throw it under the desk here. How are you, Benny? How's dipping lately? Good, you know? You go in and they say, what do you want? You should communicate to them more often. You know, the darndest thing that happened in a society, if the citizens in a neighborhood would drop in on the local police station every now and then and say, well, how are things going, Sergeant? Those police would become intensely human. Now, the funny part of it is anybody in the society or on any dynamic that you think you're having trouble with, you're also thinking another thought about. You can't communicate with them. If you're having trouble with somebody or something anywhere, it must be that you have another thought along with it, and that is, I can't communicate with it. Just think that over. Next time you think you're having an awful lot of trouble somewhere, well, just wonder whether or not you can't communicate with it. And if you communicate it with it gently enough, it won't backfire hard. If you communicate and miscalculate a little bit and communicate too much or too fast or too much velocity, it's liable to come back and knock your head off. But that's all right. Put your head back on and communicate again. That's always what you must do. The reason you stopped communicating in the first place is you lost a few heads. But what are heads? Expendable. The thing which you must do is communicate again on that channel. You'll find out if you do that several times, whatever was trying to knock your head off will kind of go into apathy and communicate with you. Very, very remarkable. Well, out of Scientology, we get quite a few answers. They are answers which you had once upon a time, if you don't have them now. But they're answers which got buried in an enormous pile of very impressive facts. Tremendous pile of facts. All of them equally true. All the drops of water in the ocean were drops of water. And every one, if you considered it a fact, was equally important with every other fact. Only that isn't so. There were some facts that were important. There are some drops of water that were important in that ocean of water. Some facts that were important in that pile of facts. And all Scientology is doing, and where it wins, is when it gives back into your possession facts which you already knew were true and lets you discard, because your sudden recognition of this truth, an enormous amount of junk and stuff and considerations that not only are not true, but are quite burdensome for you to carry around. In other words, it gives you a smaller bit of luggage as far as education and so forth. But more important than that, having then a better command of the facts and life at your command, you can, of course, do more with life itself, since you aren't held back from communicating on every front by the belief that some enormous barrier stands between you and one of the dynamics of the rest of the world. There's nothing stands between you and any other part of the entirety of this or any other universe. If you want to put it to the test, I invite you to. You'll be a happier person. Thank you.